Hello again and welcome back, everybody. This is the Product Uncensored show. My name is Colin and I am the host of this show. Today's episode, super special episode, right? I think I alluded to this in the previous episode, but today is episode number 40 for the show, which means that the Product Uncensored show has now officially reached midlife crisis. So I'm excited. I never figured I would get to 40 episodes when I first started. It was supposed to be an experiment, and it's been fun. It's really been amazing people that I've been speaking to, and today's guest is no exception, right? It's also special for me for this particular episode because this guest, he will be my first guest who is based out of Africa. So I can now say, I think, if my geography doesn't fail me, that the Product Uncensored show has had guests from every continent in the world. So yes, he was a product manager at Grab. He was a product manager at Meta. He's currently the chief product officer at Kapu. And he's joining us all the way from Nairobi in Kenya, the Silicon Savannah. So please welcome to the show, Matthias Kratz. Welcome to the show, Matthias.
Thank you very, very much, Colin. Amazing. Thanks for having me here on the show. And like, first of all, congratulations to all those milestones.
Yes. It didn't really occur to me until the last episode. I'm like, wow, it's 39 and today would be 40. I was like, wow, this is, you know, really, really happy that we've, you know, managed to come this far. And, you know, maybe before we start, you know, first of all, thank you for joining me first thing in your morning. It's not exactly the best timings, I know, but thank you for helping to try and manage it a little bit. I thought maybe before you give your introduction, and I wanted to tell our viewers and listeners a little bit about who Matthias Kratz is, right? And the thing that I really remember about Matthias was, we were just talking about this just before we started the recording as well, that, you know, he has been someone who had this dream of going to do product in Africa. And I always thought that was something that was very, very different from every product person that I know. I've never heard of anyone wanting to go to Africa to do product. And when I saw one of his posts, I was like, yes, you know, why has it taken me this long to get him on the show? And that's why I reached out and say, Matthias, I think it's time for us to talk about your journey as a product leader to Africa. So that's how this all came about. So maybe, Matthias, you can start off by telling us a little bit more about yourself.
Yeah, good memory, first of all, Colin, because I do remember that a couple of years back when you were considering to start a product podcast, we were talking, and I think at that moment I told you that I would want to go to Africa. Yes. And yeah, I think the loop has closed now after the 40th episode. here I am. So yeah, no, I mean, a bit about myself, I guess. I think you have already covered the big highlights in my product career, but maybe for a couple of more steps, like I'm originally from Germany, if you haven't recognized my accent already. Have been all about traveling, experiencing new cultures. I was living in the Middle East before coming to Southeast Asia. Then was in Southeast Asia for a bit. That's where I actually really took my first official product management job, and which was at Grab. Amazing experience. I think we'll be maybe chatting about this a bit later. And then was trying to see, like, okay, so how is product management, you know, growth? Grab was in this hyper growth stage at the time that I joined. And I was like, okay, that's super exciting, but like, let's see how it is at a more established place. So that was at the time when I joined Facebook, back then Facebook, now Meta. So a very different phase of product management. And I think after those experiences, I was like, okay, let's go back to step one, where I have started like 8 years before that, starting my first company that failed miserably. And then I had my second company that still failed, but less miserably. So I felt like I'm now better prepared to start something new again. And so I went back, and like, now I'm here at Kapu, and I'm a founding team member of Kapu, and the chief product officer, aka the person that does everything. so yeah, that's where we are right now. And like, I'm based out of Nairobi, which is amazing. Enjoying it a lot. So far, no regrets on my steps.
Nice. So let's pick up where you just kind of, you were ending the introduction of you tried doing two startups. They both failed miserably. And one of the things that I realize that is kind of a, I won't say it's, I detect it a lot, but I seem to see that quite a lot of product folks actually have had experience trying to do their own thing, right? You know, I tried doing my own thing. I won't say it failed miserably, but I definitely think it petered out in the end. You've done it, and quite a big number of proportion of the guests that I've had on this show had also tried something, you know, before that. Mm-hmm. Do you think that part of being a good product person, right, is having a little bit of that experience of having, you know, put your hands, getting it dirty, and then trying to do it yourself? And did that, was that something that really helped you in your product career?
Absolutely, I think. This is super important because you learn out of the failures that you have. And like, I mean, as a product manager, right, like we are often so much at the center of kind of driving innovation and driving something new that has an impact. And I think it is all good and great that you have all the theory there, right? But like when you once need to do something yourself, right, you need to kind of throw out all this theory and say like, that is good knowledge to have. But what really matters, no matter is the means, you need to get to the ends, right? Mm-hmm. And I think by failing and by doing that yourself, I think you see, you learn a lot. And that, I think, helps you whatever place you go afterwards and say, okay, good, I've had that experience, right? Mm-hmm. I'm trying to avoid those big mistakes. And I'm not like discrediting anyone who's kind of starting from an associate product manager position, right? Which is, I think, I would have appreciated a lot in my career. But I think that specific failure was also something that has shaped you. And for me, it was two consecutive ones. I mean, failure, I think I said miserably failed, right? It's kind of like because I was learning all those tools and how to use them, but it wasn't just like leading to a big exit or something, right? But like it was a great growth experience. Yeah, if you want to frame it from a different perspective.
Yeah, agreed. I mean, I did talk about this anecdote with another guest. I can't remember from which episode about, you know, in one of the companies where I was the VP of product, and one of the tech guys was asking me, we were having lunch, and he was saying, you know, I know about your story about, you know, when you tried to do your own business and it failed, right? He said, do you like regret it? I was like, no, I mean, for me, it was really out of, you know, same like you, right? You know, you're young, you think you can do everything, you want to try, no commitments at that time. And I realized all the things I did wrong, right? If anything, I think those missteps and decisions actually made me a better product person, I felt anyway. That's why I wanted to, you know, ask you about it, because I wanted to know whether, you know, I'm the only one who feels that way, or is that like something you also agree with as well?
Absolutely. I agree. I think for me, the biggest learning during that time was, I mean, my first startup was like, you know, there was this idea, and then, you know, then reality hit, right? Like there was like very little product discovery, the customer discovery, you know, like MVP that was like, yeah, we're going to do that, right? We have all this funding now, let's do this. And that was me being like 26 or something, coming out of an investment banking job and like totally new to everything. No idea about product management, really. And while I was doing it, I didn't really know that I was doing product management. I was just trying to build this thing. And yeah, it didn't pan out, right? Because of these things. Startup number two was the total opposite. It was like, now I learned everything. I read all the books that you could read. Right. I was like, okay, product discovery, we need to do that first, right? We need to build this MVP. And we did, and it was great. And I had a lot of success with this. It failed due to more other reasons, because we built on top of a government technology that the government shut us down on. But at the end, this was a great learning. It showed me like, okay, that's the way to do it, right? Like, and I think specifically this learning is something that I'm using now at Kapu. Okay. Where we're also very early stage, right? And mm-hmm. I think the experience of, if you go to Grab or if you go to Meta, these are great places where you learn a lot of the hard skills of product management and how to do this at a really great level, but in a big company, right? But it would not have taught me all these things that I have learned in my startups, right? Because Meta will not let you just throw out an MVP there, like that is so scrappy, right? The same, I mean, similar to Grab in some way, right? Like at that point when I was there. So I think kind of fusing these experiences together is super powerful and helpful for me.
Okay. We'll go back to that when we talk about Kapu, because I'm really, you know, I mean, the one thing that I really want to make sure we cover in this episode is really how you ended up in Africa with Kapu and that whole story of Kapu, because I don't know, I'm personally interested, and I'm hoping everybody else who's listening is also interested. So we'll keep that for a little bit. But let's rewind a little bit, right? I'm actually very curious to understand. So I met Matthias in Singapore. In Singapore, right? And it's always been very curious for me, like, how does a German end up in Singapore doing product management for Grab? So yeah, what was it that made you want to go to Singapore in the first place?
I was in Singapore in 2006 already for back then an internship when I was still studying. So I really had a bit of exposure to Southeast Asia, and I loved the place. I loved the ability of like traveling around and seeing all these different cultures in such a small space or small range, right? Mm-hmm. That was amazing. At that time, I was living in Beirut with my wife. And so I was like, that's great, right? I was like, trying to bring my experience from previously to kind of coach people in Beirut in the tech scene. But I think Lebanon, as it has today, it has its difficulties, right? Like in terms of like the country and the stability. So there was very little growth in the ecosystem at that time. And I wanted to see a bit more of let's call it sophisticated product management, right? So that I can learn and make the next steps in my career. And I was like always talking for a long time, should I maybe go to Singapore, right? And I have to like credit that to my wife. She just bought me a one-way ticket to Singapore. And wow. I was being sent to Singapore. And I was staying at a friend's place. And that's when my six to 8 weeks job hunt started. So I was going to all the events that you could possibly go to in Singapore, where people met. Then I met a very, very cool guy that I just wrote on LinkedIn, fellow German as well, who was a product manager at Grab, and met him for coffee, told him my story. And he was excited to kind of recommend me. And I think I also have to credit this, me getting the job at the end, I have to credit to a fellow podcast visitor or guest here, Fabian, who was my first manager at Grab and who took a chance on me, essentially, because, I mean, I didn't have the particular product management profile, right? Like, I didn't have formal product management role before, but talking to him and he saw maybe something in me. And so, you know, like as I guess many product managers, there is no one path to it, right? So, and he said, like, look, let's come in. And that's the way that I got to product management in Singapore. And then I said, okay, I found something. That's cool. Let's move to Singapore. Let's try it out.
Nice. So yes, definitely have to give your wife credit. This is definitely first instance of me hearing, you know, hey, you know what? I've bought my husband a one-way ticket to go to this foreign country to go and find a job. Like, you know, like, wow, that's
maybe I was whining enough. I was whining and she was like, that's not going to continue.
Let's stop this shit. Like, here's the flight ticket and do it. And then if you know, let's see what happens. So, okay.
Exactly.
Yeah, and also, you know, kudos to Fabian as well, who's now the CPO at Lineman Wong Nai. I think he was guest 36, 37, one of those, which is also incidentally now our most popular episode of the podcast. It's overtaken the all-time record. So, yeah, if you haven't listened to it, you know, go. I highly recommend you listening to it. It was a really interesting session as well. But coming back to the point of, you know, what Matthias was saying about, you know, how Fabian kind of took a chance, I actually think that that is something that makes product management very special, right? Because we don't, up until now, there's no real technical discipline. You know, you can't go to university and study product. I mean, one or two universities have started doing it, but it's not something as established as, like, let's say, engineering or even software engineering for that matter. But, you know, some of the most amazing product people have come without all the paperwork and all the experience. But it is because they kind of had that something that, you know, the manager looks for, right? And, you know, in your case, you know, Fabian obviously saw something that, you know, he liked, and look where you are now. You know, and even for me, I didn't have the chops, right? But my manager took a chance because, again, he was very intrigued that I tried doing my own thing and failed, but I still did. And yeah, you know, that journey has been amazing. So yeah, to all you aspiring product folks out there, don't give up, right? You know, you've heard what Matthias did, right? He literally got a one-way ticket, went there, went to every single event that he could find, you know, linked up with whoever he could, tried to get as many interviews. Even the episode with Renato was the same thing. He was traveling through Southeast Asia, just went for interviews, got a job. So I think that kind of hustle is helpful. And don't give up, right? Because I know right now the market is a lot more mature in that sense, in terms of just quantity of people doing product as well. But again, I still believe that there's a lot of product leaders out there who are looking for candidates with that special something. You don't necessarily need to have the experience, but the manager and the company are in that right state to take up you know, that raw gem or that unpolished, unfinished piece of product management leadership, right? Yeah, so hopefully that helps. I wanted to, just go down that path again. So Matthias, one of the things that you mentioned was when you joined Grab, they weren't at that hyper growth stage yet. When you left, I think they were already in that phase, right? Am I correct?
No, I think that they actually were in that stage when I joined them. I'm kind of like, we had this internal Slack channel, and I think I joined at about like product manager number 60 that was in that channel. Okay. And I think at the time when I left, there were maybe 200 product managers. And I was there for 2.5 years. So, I mean, if you think of, like, you know, the ratios of product managers to engineers and other folks around, so that was like a huge growth that we underwent. But I'm pretty sure that there was already like a starting point of this when I joined, because just before I joined, there was the acquisition or the merger between Uber and Grab. And
after that?
That was in March and I joined in June.
Okay.
And I think that was this whole like incorporation of like all the folks from Uber that kind of like added a lot of people to the team. Mm-hmm. And then Grab Food was started in collaboration with DoorDash, right, from the US. So I think like a lot of these things came in at that time.
So great question to lead into then, right? You know, so what was it like to do product management at Grab at that time, right? You know, just had that sort of acquisition merger with Uber, you know, DoorDash was coming in. This was the real start or genesis of the super app for Grab. What was it like?
I feel it was like described like a rocket ship, like it's when people always say this, right? Like, it's a bit like the same phrase, but I think it was like that, right? Like, if you were out for a week and you came back from a holiday, if you had one, everything changed, right? Like, new teams were there. Like, this happened. So I think it was so fast paced. I had an amazing experience there. And I think, like, also all the things that we were, like, pushed to do, it was really a great culture of, you know, you need to go on the ground and learn what is going on. And that was like super encouraged by management. So we had, again, a Slack channel. You would just put in, I'm traveling next week to the Philippines, and then I'm traveling to Vietnam. And you just got your approval in a thread by your manager. And you were just flying around Southeast Asia all the time, because the whole point was like, you need to go on the ground and understand your customers. Mm-hmm. Because like one of the reasons why Uber sort of, I don't want to say failed, because like in the end, they got a big stake in Grab there, but like, because Grab was super hyper-local, right? They were like adapting their product to the users there. And the only way to do that is to understand those users. and trying to do this at the scale that Grab did, like send 60 product managers plus designers plus all the folks that wanted all around the 8 countries and markets in that easier way, that I think was a great way to establish this value that you need to be close to your customer to understand that. Right. Yeah. Love that part.
Okay.
Was also chaotic, but I think overall, like, an amazing experience as a product manager there.
So how did you sort of maintain the balance between, you know, making sure that, you know, Grab could grow like a rocket ship at that, you know, hyper speed, but at the same time still have sufficient time to do what you just mentioned, right, going on the ground? Because if, let's say, things change so quickly and, you know, the demands are there to deliver, right, how did you balance that when you were at Grab?
I think that, like, Grab was definitely not a 9-to-5 job. And because of that session, I think this is also super important for everyone who wants to join a certain type of company, right? Like, you need to be aware of what you're getting yourself into. And that was what Grab was, right? Like, Slack was pinging up all the time. And because you were, like, managing and multitasking a lot of things, right? You were, like, in the discovery phase for product A, you were in the execution phase for product B. You were, like, all the time doing something. And I think that the way that it actually worked at the end of the day is, like, you know, like, you have so many folks doing the same thing because it wasn't obviously only me, but so you get so many shots on goal. Right. Mm-hmm. Because everyone is shooting all the time. Right. I mean, maybe not their best and most accurate shots because they're doing 10 shots at a time. Right. But I think, but just the amount of things that you're doing, like, if 10% or, like, even 2% of those things stick, right, that's kind of what you need. And I think that's what I at least observed then, because we did a lot of things that didn't work out at Grab. Right. Like, but enough did so that the company is where it is now.
Yep, agreed. I love the candidness on that, right? Because, again, there tends to be a lot of, you know, almost fantasizing or fetishing about how, you know, oh, you know, we did this and we did that. And I think what you say is so true, right? At a company, at the speed and at the scale that Grab wanted to grow, it was a lot of it was to do with throwing things at the wall and hoping that more things stick than don't. That's what happened, right? That's really, really great insight. So just to talk a little bit more again about Grab and doing, like, discovery and stuff like that, how actually it's more a question of, did the priorities change a lot because of that growth? And, you know, if they did, you know, how did you manage it as a product manager? So obviously, you know, from Fabian's perspective, you know, we were talking more about the strategic direction, which is slightly different. And I think your perspective as, you know, someone who was under Fabian or at that level, great to hear, you know, how did you manage that, right? Did it change a lot for you, or were the tactics quite stable, you know, up to a certain extent?
No. I think that is a very interesting combination, right? Like, because Fabian obviously had more access to the more strategic part of, you know, the decision making here. And now, like, being a bit in that position, I see that there's just a lot of macro trends, a lot of movement in the market, right? The funding situation, the funding environment, the competition, right? Even you don't always want to say, I'm not going to think of the competition when I'm building something. But at the end of the day, the reality is still the reality, right? For us, like, as the folks underneath that, I think change is inevitable. It was inevitable at Grab. There was obviously a lot of frustration around this. I think it was felt throughout the teams. And I think it could have been managed better from general management's perspective. But I think it's difficult, right? Because there were thousands of people already there. But there wouldn't be, like, really, like, a streak of more than a month where there wouldn't be a reorg, or there wouldn't be a change in strategy. And kind of, like, what that meant for your personal work and for your team's work. I think, again, you needed to kind of set up your mindset around that. Back then, at that time, this one guy who got me into Grab recommended me a book that is by Reid Hoffman, Blitz Scaling.
Mm, yes.
Right. I read it at that time. And, I mean, it kind of helped me to to, without knowing what Grab was doing on a strategic level, right? It kind of like, okay, that's the reason why we're doing that, right? Like we are sort of blitz scaling. I mean, there was that time this big thing between Grab and Gojek, right? And it was all about how can you use your funds that you had, which were flowing in a lot, in the most, I want to say efficient, in the best way possible, in order to achieve those goals and out execute the other. Yeah. Right. And if you saw this in this light, then you kind of could put into perspective what has been changing on a tactical level day to day. You were maybe less agitated and you felt more like, okay, these guys seem to be knowing what they're doing, right? Or they're like trying to follow that playbook.
Yeah. So one interesting thing that I really want to ask you now, because you alluded to that, and it's something that I think, yeah, it's probably playing on the mind of a lot of product managers as well. So you said, right, at that point in time in Grab, you didn't have as much access to what the strategic goals of Grab were. And then, you know, like now at Kapu, you're actually kind of, you know, being on the other side of the fence, so to speak. If let's say you were at Grab all over again now, and you had more access to understanding Grab's strategic goals and how the macro trends were happening, the competition, the funding, all of that, do you think that would have helped you A, make better decisions, and B, helped you deal with the sort of frustration that was coming out of this, you know, constant changing and switching and pivoting and whatnot?
I think great question, and something that I have no predefined answer. But when I think of course, like if you, the more you know, the better, right? Like if you think of that's context, right? Like you have context now, you can put your own action into that context, and that helps you to get some sort of, you know, peace of mind that, you know, what you're doing is actually going into the right direction. I think it is super tough to build that context. And I think that management was trying, right? Like, I mean, Fabian, I remember he was always like trying to give this context. But there was also a certain limit, right? Because it was just growing so fast and in so many directions, right? That I think even Fabian wouldn't have all the context that you would need. So I think there was a bit of a, in some way, you know, don't try to understand everything. Just try to kind of focus on your area, try to get the strategy from there, try to get the context. And that's what I would do, is like try to provide that context, right? And be very open to, we don't know everything. What we know is this. This is our environment, our ecosystem, our small vacuum in which we are operating in, right? Which is, for me, in my case, I was in the driver experience team. So I did not necessarily need to know what Grab Financials was doing, right? And I think providing as much context as possible is, I think, helpful for people to take good decisions.
Okay.
Then the thing that comes in there, right, like, is actually another interesting part, because there is this always this question about like long term and short term, right? Like you evaluate it more in the short term, right? And then there are these long term goals that you're having. So you sometimes think, okay, this is long-term, not the right decision, but what we are trying to achieve now, that's the right thing to do. And I think this is very important, and I would have loved to have this more, and I'm trying to do this right now. We are like a very early stage company, but like even Grab at that time, there were short-term goals, and it's okay to say, look, it doesn't matter about how this pans out in the long-term, right? The goal must be achieved. The next one is this one. We can always change later. Right? Yeah. Especially when you're not dealing with this legacy of, I have a multi-billion-dollar company like Facebook, changing a button on the newsfeed is going to make a big difference, right? Versus we are all to play for. And I think this is what I would have loved a bit more, so that you kind of develop a bit more of a risk taker attitude. Mm-hmm. And that makes a difference than, oh yeah, I don't know whether I should do this because this could fall on my feet, right? Yeah. 2 quarters down the line.
No, I love that point where you're talking about, you know, the reality of the long term and the short term. You know, I've had these conversations with some of my team members quite recently as well. And I was telling them that, you know, of course, what you always want to do is, you know, do something that's going to be helpful in the long term. You don't want to go for the quick wins, you know. And of course, all your product gurus will always tell you that, right? Don't snack and things like that. But you know, that's where I think what you said in the beginning, right? The reality of product management in the real world versus the ideals, they're not always the same, right? Sometimes you have to snack. Sometimes you have to do this. Sometimes it's not going to be what you want. And sometimes, you know, you just have to take it because it's now. The opportunity is now. It's not going to come back again. The market conditions are right. You just have to do it. And if you don't, you're going to miss it, right? And that's something that, you know, no book is going to tell you enough about. So,
yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Let's move on from Grab. Sorry. I really wanted to, you know, pick your brain a little bit. So then you went to Meta, and now I'm very curious because one of the things that I read recently about how Meta does things is that, well, again, this is all, you know, what people write, so I have no firsthand knowledge of this, is that they tend to be more structured versus Google, where Google had more of this builder's mindset where they would still build stuff and break it. And then, you know, if it didn't work out, they would just bury it or, you know, not do it anymore. So that was the comparison of what I was reading. Mm-hmm. And you were at Meta. Did you feel that as a product person in Meta, that was kind of the way that they did it? Everything was more structured, more, I mean, I won't say risk averse, but if let's say we were to compare it with some other tech companies, they would tend to be less of a risk-taking organization. Is that true?
I mean, the difficulty is I cannot really compare. I can give you my sense of how I felt Meta was doing. Yeah. I didn't have the opportunity to be at Google or anywhere to kind of like have a good one-for-one comparison. I actually did feel very different about Meta. I felt Meta was a very non-structured environment. And the teams were very autonomous, and it was all about bottoms up, right? Like there were very loose goals given from management, and it was really upon the product manager and the team and the engineering manager and the designer to come up with, look, based on what you have told us, right, this is what we think we are going to do. Propose a sort of half year's plan. This is my strategy, right? This is my plan. And then you would kind of go out and present that to your managers and your managers' managers. And then these guys would say, oh, look, this good or nah, right? But they give you a thumbs up and then you're off to the races. And there's a check-in every 4 to 6 weeks. Where are you on that path? You're meant to kind of deliver that proactively, like context people where things are going. My experience was I was very little, like not bothered, but like I was given a lot of free reins around what I was doing. Maybe I was providing enough context for people to kind of be able to follow me without having to kind of like point me. That was very different to Grab. Grab was at that time, maybe because of the need that it had, right, was very tight ship. And it was very much like, we need to do this. You guys need to do that. The next guy needs to do this, right? And you almost had your goals given by them, right? Versus at Meta, like you set up your own OKRs, you set up everything yourself, and you build up your own processes, right? Like for example, when I was joining, my team didn't have no sort of Scrum, no sort of Kanban. They were just like coding stuff, right? And there was this bunch of 10 people coding stuff, right? Like, and then you're like, okay, but like, how do you deliver things, right? And then they're like, yeah, but we just do it, right? Like, and then it was like up on the team to figure out, okay, is this the best way to do things? Or should we maybe should we have sprints, right? Like nobody was really like, it's all up on you. You have your goals, how you deliver those goals that you set up yourself, up on you. So I felt this was for such a big company, quite unstructured.
Yeah.
And I do agree, though, with the part of, oh, let's build this and throw it away. I think there was a very hard performance culture, and it was super data-driven. And I think that there could have been a bit more focus on innovation, right? Like, kind of to say, like, you know, oh, 60% of this is our basic work, 30% is growth, and 10% is moonshots. I think there was too little put on the moonshot idea. And I think that's kind of like what Google does quite well, like to say, okay, we know that this part is maybe we just throw it away, right? Like if it doesn't work out. Maybe there's also the part in the area that I was working in. I was working in security. Maybe you don't want to have moonshot ideas in security because that could go just the other way around. But yeah, I think that was interesting. Like okay. How such a big company is still operating.
Mm-hmm. And thank you for drawing that comparison to Grab, because that was going to be my next question. Like, how was that compared to Grab? So you already done that for me. So then the question would be then, you know, you've actually highlighted two very contrasting cultures in which you are a product manager. Mm-hmm. For you, right, which one do you think was better for you? Like, did you, and this is personal, right? I'm not saying, you know, it's better for the entire mm-hmm. industry, but I'm just saying that from your perspective, did you enjoy that, you know, Facebook type where even OKRs were done by you, you decided what you want to do, and then it was up to you to prove that you've managed to hit those targets?
Mm-hmm.
Or in the Grab where you felt like, yes, although it was tight, but at least I always had that clarity of what was going to happen, 1, 2, 3, 4.
Mm-hmm. I think it is a bit of both. I really like the ability to kind of decide my own faith, if you want so, right? And I have my own plan and kind of like also pushed you a bit more out of your comfort zone to, I don't want to say that people at Grab or product managers at Grab a bit more project manager, because it's absolutely not true. But I think part of this product management is like, you give me your ideas based on the problems that you understand, right? And you chart your path and your strategy for your team or like your larger team, whatever that is. So I did really enjoy this piece, right? Like, because it made me grow a lot in that area. It's also like a personal growth, because I wasn't, you know, there's always this fear of failure. Like, you need to put yourself out there in order to, need to make a difference, right? Mm-hmm. Like, if you're like playing it too safe, then there is nothing. And you could kind of play it a bit safe at Grab, because the goals were given sort of to you, right? Like, you were the particular person that was driving this metric, right? And then I felt more like I was doing, yeah, more things to kind of drive that metric, but like, I didn't think too much about the bigger picture. And at Facebook, that was different. Now, on the other side, I really enjoyed the pace at Grab, right? And because there was much less red tape, even though, you know, like, Facebook was unstructured, but there was more red tape around this, right? Like, it was moving as fast as Grab. So I think this kind of, this combination of things, like, would have been the perfect list. Maybe that is going to be Kapu.
Okay. Interesting that you say that Facebook or Meta, you know, had more red tape. Was the red tape because of, like, let's say in your case, you were working security, or was it because, you know, just in general, right, you, if you wanted to do something that was a little bit more radical or more innovative, it had to go through your manager and your manager's manager and your manager's manager's manager? Like, what kind of red tape were you dealing with?
I think it just, like, any organizations, I mean, I haven't at least seen a different organization where you have legacy, right? Like, it is kind of like you have something to lose, right? If you have something to lose, then people are like, you know, on the lookout where you could lose. And that kind of creates a lot of red tape to make sure that everyone is aligned and everyone is like signing up for what you're like suggesting, several layers of people. And so when you wanted to make a big thing happen, you had to do this. In your small area, that was not the case, right? But I think it's one of the things that like we leaders have to work on to keep a big organization innovative, right? Yeah. So that we kind of like create these places and there's room for product managers and everyone in the team to be able to, you know, be innovative and like push the boundaries and keep innovating. And I think that was the reason, because Grab, you know, there was just, I wouldn't say nothing to lose, because, but there was still less to lose, right? Like there was,
it was an open fight. Go home, because, yeah, you know, they, yeah. Yeah, they had to do something in order to not go bust, right? It's either you will be number one or you were nothing. So,
yeah, exactly. All or nothing, so to say.
Yeah. Okay. All right. So that's very interesting. So let's go to a little bit about Kapu. But before we go there, right? Question that I've been dying to ask you, that I actually don't know why I didn't ask you when you first told me that you wanted to, you know, go to Africa and do product management, is why Africa? Like, what is there some link or, you know, some intrinsic reason that, you know, Africa pulls at your heartstrings? Or what is it that drew you to Africa?
I think it's just like I'm somebody who's having a bit, I don't know, like problems with authorities, in the sense of like people that tell me what to do. It's not really, I was struggling. I mean, everyone was struggling during COVID, right? And Singapore, I was struggling a lot. And I think Africa is like this kind of, and it is like now being here a year and a half or two, it is this vast place where you can be very creative. You can be, you know, I mean, and I'm talking more about on my private side, right? Like less of so on the work side, but like, because this drew me at the beginning, right? Like, it's like this open country. You can do so many things. You can go out camping, just drive with my four-wheel drive out an hour. I'm on a volcano, put up my tent. Nobody cares. As long as you're like, you know, not destroying the environment, and you're kind of, you know, can do all these things. And that's what drew me to Africa and more the lifestyle. Than the work. But when I kind of like was trying, when I was like figuring out, like, you know, how does life and work come together, I saw a big opportunity in Africa. And I think many people do, like, but if you just, I mean, well, today Africa is about 1.5 billion people, right? It's forecasted to grow to 2.5 billion people by 2050. Africa by that time will be the largest workforce in the world. Kenya, 55 million people. Average age in Kenya is 19.6 years.
Wow.
40% of people are below 14 years old. This is not only for Kenya. This is across sub-Saharan Africa, right? So just think of the opportunities that are going to come, right? And the majority of people are not yet digitized, right? Smartphones, I've just looked up before our call because I knew that you would want to ask something like that. Just check the cheapest smartphone I could get on the online market is $30, right? So I can get a smartphone for $30. I was in the Masai Mara, which is like this big national park, like in the middle of nowhere. I had 4G.
Wow, right? Okay.
And, so like, if you kind of like combine a lot of these things, right, then you're seeing a lot of opportunity for digital business models to, you know, to get a foothold. I think we're still super early in this, but I mean, if you look at the wave of growth in Southeast Asia over the last 15 years, and I mean, I wasn't there from the beginning in Southeast Asia, but I can see like so many similarities, but at such higher pace, because obviously, you know, the smartphone and the internet penetration is allowing now so many things to happen at much, much cheaper prices. And that's what one of the things that Kapu does, right? It is kind of trying to get a foothold now in these markets and then grow with these markets. And there's still fewer competition around us. So I think you could look out now in Southeast Asia and like you look at the startup scene and you say, like, I see all these business models and I see how they're slowly popping up over here.
Right.
And I think that is kind of like where the work part came in. And then I was like, oh, yeah, great. So I'm definitely not kind of like betting on a losing horse in some way here, right? Like there's growth. It will just take its time. And like, meanwhile, I can enjoy my life and do all the fun stuff that I like doing.
Okay. All right. Okay. Cause yeah, I was just very curious, you know, why Africa? So it's more the personal side of things. And then there was that opportunity where you could also do professionally what you do well or do
yeah.
well, and then combine the both, right? Okay. Yeah. Okay. So then when you went to Africa, so with Kapu, you're part of the founding team. How does that differ then, you know, now that you're a CPO and you're a founding member as well, which means that, you know, and you said it yourself, Kapu is a very early stage startup. How does that compare with what you used to do in Grab at Meta?
Just let me
break it down a little, because I know, you know, that sounds like a super huge question, right? It could probably take like 30 minutes to answer. But let's talk about first in terms of what is the scene like in Kenya, right? Because I know Kenya is known as like what, Silicon Savannah. It's supposed to be like the hub of Africa for tech. But is that you know, anywhere close to what Southeast Asia or maybe even Europe or the US in terms of the scene, where and you know, what is lacking, what is good, and where did you struggle?
Yeah, look, maybe just give you like a bit of the scene around like this first. I think, as I said, the scene or like the place has a lot of opportunity. I think we are still super early. And that super early translates into talent, into access to financing, right? Especially now in this market crunch. Companies have struggles and companies go out of business because of that. And I think it is a great place to be in, but you need to kind of adapt your style and you need to adapt the way that you think about things when you come here. And yeah, I think overall, I think you have to kind of like be more hands-on here than manage through context, which is kind of like what you're doing maybe in other markets. And have to have a business model that is like playing to the basic needs of people where you can kind of like make something happen, right? Versus like build the next fancy SaaS software or like social enterprise or something like this. Yeah.
Okay. So it's more, I think the needs that you're trying to meet is more basic, is what I'm hearing. Then in terms of the management style, it's more you got to sort of teach people how things work. Is that what you were saying as well?
Yeah, exactly. Like, I think you need to be very, very much involved. And the great thing here is that the people are very entrepreneurial, right? Like, now there was this, the recent elections, and Kenya was like coined as the hustler nation. And it's true, right? Everyone is a hustler here. Everyone needs to hustle in order to make ends meet, right? If you have people that are doing this, this is a great place for entrepreneurs, right? Because everyone here, everyone has a side hustle, no matter what you earn and do. Everyone has a side hustle. So that is already a great setup, like for the minds and how the people are wired in order to make things happen. And you have a lot of people that are wanting to be entrepreneurial and wanting to open up something themselves. Now, I think if you infuse a bit more, let's say, call it guidance or like some of the experience in the digital side of businesses into this group of folks, right? There's tremendous opportunity for them to grow. But there's not that many folks around that have already gotten all this experience from like abroad, from all these a bit more developed markets, and are now ready to set this up, right? For example, like in Nairobi, we have now Google has a hub, Microsoft has a hub, all kind of recently still established, right? So they are sucking in a lot of the talent, which might be a bit detrimental at the moment to the ecosystem, right? Because like, who wants now to work for Carpool if they can work for Google, right? But at the same time, I think this is a natural cycle, and maybe correct me if I'm wrong, Colin, but like, I think Southeast Asia, like so many years back, is a similar cycle, right? The people are starting to kind of like, some folks are starting to get the big jobs either abroad or in the companies that come there, right? Then they go abroad with those companies. And eventually after some years, they return, right? And they're bringing a lot of that experience back, right? And then they say, okay, I'm back in Southeast Asia. I've been like, I don't know, in Silicon Valley now, and I have done this and I've kind of seen all these things. I want to bring it back and I want to open a startup now here, right? And that's where the loop sort of closes. And I think we are not yet at that closure of this loop in Kenya or anywhere in Africa, right? And so I think it's a natural cycle. So you are just waiting for this to happen, right? So you have all these hustlers that are wanting to do things here, right? And they're very entrepreneurial. And then you now need to infuse a bit more of that knowledge and of that how to do things in a digital way. And then you're going to kind of see a lot of, yeah, these businesses come up. And then you need to also have the right funding environment and enough appetite for risk from the investors, which was there up to a year and a half back. I think it's going to come back eventually. But at the moment, I think we are more in this learning phase, right? Like, and yeah.
Good points, right? So again, I'm trying to just play back what I heard you say, right? So, you know, with Nairobi or, you know, / Kenya being such a that hustler nation, that entrepreneurial spirit, I guess the benefit then is that you get to harness that sort of, you know, and guide or direct that kind of energy and appetite into how you build startups, how you build tech companies, how you, you know, do the next Grab, the next Meta, the next Kapoor, right? And that there. But in terms of the maturity of the product practices and product experience in Kenya, what's the scene like there?
I think still not that far developed overall. There's a lot of interest in it. We've recently had a product tank, so I've moved from being a co-organizer and product tank in Singapore to Nairobi now. We've had our first Nairobi event. Right?
Okay, yeah, because exactly. I was just you know, reading up on product tank in Nairobi. I was like, wow, there's a product tank in Nairobi. I'm so impressed.
Yeah, exactly. So like, there was a bit of a break in the last year, 2 years because of COVID, but we have just revived it. We had our first event. There was a lot of interest from people coming in. And I think, again, like, there's a lot of raw diamonds, and we are lucky, I think, to call ourselves one of the places that has a few of those raw diamonds. And I think it's about, like, kind of trying to help them to kind of make their next steps, right? Like, by bringing in experiences that we have or that I have that were not that easy to get here yet. And what I was just trying to say before, when I was babbling around a bit about the scene at the beginning, was like, I think that the adapting your style of management, right? Where you're like, let's say we are like in a very, very experienced group of people, right? You're managing a lot through context. You provide as much context as you want, as you can, and the people will figure out their ways, right? Because they're all super aligned and want to do the same thing, have done it a couple of times. And I think that change is what I wanted to get to, is like, you have this group of people that are like very, very like excited, and they have good jobs to get started, but they need to have a bit more like closer management, right? To kind of help them do things. And I think that's what I was struggling at the beginning when I was coming here, right? How do you be effective in the market when you come from somewhere else? You just bring all your knowledge, and then you need to, it obviously doesn't work, right? You need to adapt it to the local nuances of the market that you're working in. And so I think that is kind of what we are all trying to do, not only in our company.
Okay. So again, just leading on from what you said, right? So from your perspective as someone who, and correct me if I'm not reading this correctly, I'm assuming that the scene that you worked with in Southeast Asia with Grab and Meta is more more mature than the scene in Nairobi. So for you as now the CPO, how do you hire in Nairobi? Like, you know, because you're saying, right, it's not as mature. You can kind of, you know, there's still a lot of diamonds in the rough. So what are you looking for when you're trying to hire in Nairobi for Kapoor?
I think that you need to change very much how you hire. I have started hiring, but like adopting many of these practices that I've learned at Grab and at Meta, how to interview. And I think you just need to kind of figure out much more what is the characteristics of the people, or how they come across, right? Are they willing to learn? You know, have they done something? What have they done? What kind of side hustle do they have, right? What is the environment that they are coming from, right? How have they shown, you know, their willingness to learn? You know, whether how brave are they, you know, like to embark on this, because it's not a comfortable journey. So I think you need to kind of go a bit more into I try to understand your character, understand who you are as a person, versus like, oh, you come with these five companies on your CV and you have done all these things, right? That is, I think, not that relevant for us, because you will not find people.
Yeah. Okay. So you're banking more on the potential. You're looking at, okay, I think that, you know, based on this personality traits and, you know, what this person has shown, it could be a fit.
Exactly. And I think what you will be ending up doing, and that's kind of like at a bigger scale maybe, but it's the same at what Grab had, right? Like you will not be able to fill all the seats with the people that are locally here.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, why am I here? Right. Like, because like you will need to find some folks that are coming from abroad that want to take the same risk, that will have the appetite, and they come with the experience, and they can be a multiplier on that, right? And then you will grow within internally as well, and then this loop will close, and some folks will come back, and we'll see that you're like, I don't know, but at some point, hopefully a Series B company, and like they'll say, oh, let's try to get into this, right? Like, and so they have the same cycle
okay.
that you had at Grab or Southeast Asia, I suppose.
Understood. Okay. So then now, as you know, in Kapu, you're the CPO, and earlier we were just talking about how, you know, Grab brand is really tight ship. Meta was the loosey-goosey comparative, you know, between the two. How are you building your team in Kapu? How are you building up the product practice in Kapu? Like, what's your style? You know, what are you, what have you taken from the Meta side of things? What have you taken from Grab?
Yeah, I think my personal style is more like somebody who manages or like with context. And I'm, as I said, like I adapted and I learned. And I think I moved on that spectrum a bit more to the middle, right? And I also try to adapt my style as much as I can to the individual that I'm managing, right? So I think that is very important because like all the people are at different stages of their careers. Mm. And one size fits all, that's not going to work. So I'm a very hands-on person. I'm building products myself. We are not that many people. We are 3 product managers. And so I obviously also overlook analytics and design and user research, but I'm also a product manager. Mm. Right. So I think it's super important to lead by the example and this was a learning, right? Like at the beginning, I was like more like trying to give people the direction, right? And try to have them do it and kind of come back and then like show them and talk to them. But I think what works much better is like, let's get into the, jump into the deep end, do it yourself, show people how to do it, and then have people mimic what you do and have and help people learn from that perspective. I mean, that's what I'm doing like on a day to day. I'm just had yesterday with my user research in the market. I try to go out in the market every week to kind of like also like do the same thing as we have had at Grab, right? Which is like show people how important it is to be on the ground every day. And yeah, lead by example. I think that's kind of where it comes down to.
I think it's a really interesting point that you bring up, right? And again, you know, I was kind of smiling when you were talking about that because, you know, there's a lot of similarities with what you were saying as well, you know, and I've also had to recently, you know, show the team like, hey, you know, this is how you do it, right? Because first you try to lead with the, okay, I'm going to be the mentor and the coach. And in certain cases, it just doesn't work, right? And the best way is just like, hey, let's do this together, or, you know, I get down into the trenches and I show you how it's done. And then people can mimic that. And sometimes that is probably one of the most powerful ways, right? Because when people see that, oh, okay, now I understand, it stopped living in the abstract of my mind, and it is now, you know, steps that I can take in order to try and reach this the same outcome, or the, you know, replicate that kind of whatever I've seen. So that's why I thought, you know, that was really, really cool. In terms of, I still want to sort of drive this a little bit more, right? In terms of management style at Kapu now, how do you run your team? Do you run it on OKRs, KPIs, or is it still too early for that? So you're basically just, okay, we're going by milestones. So I'm just very curious to know, how does Mateus run the ship at Kapu?
Yeah, I think like this is because we are so early stage, right? Like, and we are like, we raised our pre-seed, we raised our seed. We are now 18 months into our seed round. We are kind of preparing towards the Series A, right? So this is a very early stage part of the business, and we are still very much in the figuring out what we are going to do. So there's so many changes that you're having every day or every week. You have learnings that you need to kind of translate into, okay, look, strategy changed. So I'm much more on the, we are working like Grab sort of. Then we are working on the Meta side of things. That's due to the stage of the business. And so basically what does that mean for me is it is very much like hands-on, being there every week, check on the performance, right? We have OKRs, we have quarterly OKRs. Everyone needs to set up their OKRs. that's kind of like where it comes from Meta a bit, to say, okay, here are the OKRs for the company, right? Come up with your own OKRs that are going to support this plan. But leave the option open to change those whenever need arises, right? Mm-hmm. Like, and that can be as much as monthly, right? I mean, if you do it weekly, then there's maybe a question of like, are you setting the right OKRs sort of? But like, I think on, you learn a lot of stuff within 4 weeks in that early stage of business. Mm-hmm. And I think that's kind of what we're doing. So we have our monthly OKRs. We have quarterly OKRs. We have our monthly check-ins for those.
Yep.
We have a practice in which every week, everyone in the company, right? Like not only the product team, they post out on the Slack channel, what have I done last week? What am I going to do next week or in the coming week? Right. And how are these things going to support those OKRs, which gives visibility and it gives the ability for everyone to input into this, right? Like this is like, other people are seeing, like another product manager tells the other product manager, hey, I'm seeing you doing this sort of thing, right? I'm doing that. Let's team up, right? Or the CEO has the option to kind of like also look into what everyone is doing, right? So like there's a lot of accountability and there is a lot of like collaboration that is coming around this. And then we are trying to support each other on the way to achieving those goals. So that's the way that we are managing today. Mm. Yeah.
Okay. Okay. Curious question about how you were saying how, you know, you have company level OKRs, and then you have your quarterly OKRs, which are then passed on, you know, in this scenario, the product team comes up with how are we going to impact, you know, achieve those OKRs that achieve our objectives, right? When they change, don't they actually end up changing the company OKRs as well, or do they not? Sorry, this is like more technical, you know, more getting into the weeds. I'm just very curious.
I think it comes a bit the other way around. Like in some way, it is like, okay, we are not changing the OKRs because we're seeing, you know, cannot reach this goal and then be like reducing it. Like that is really not that much the point, because we are more evaluating the tendency, right? And we're saying, okay, like this is anyways a stretch goal. I mean, we have all stretch goals and like we want to reach there. But like what we are changing is if we are saying, oh, okay, you know, person X has a change in their role requirements because we are seeing that we need to work more into helping the rollout, because we are a kind of offline business of sorts, right? Like, so we need to be very much on the ground to understand the users, and we have underestimated how much time it takes to roll something out. So we would kind of like change the OKR in that direction. Say, okay, you have an extra OKR here, focus a bit more on this. Mm-hmm. And it wouldn't really change the overall OKRs of the company, right? So it would be more learning that's coming down.
Right. Okay. So it sounds like, you know, if the OKRs do change, it may be the quantum, right? So if let's say the goal was to improve it by 30%, then we're saying, yeah, it's kind of not possible. So maybe changing it 10%. Is it something like that? Or are we saying that, you know, it could be the metric that we're moving, or is it just purely the aspect of focus, or is it something like that?
Yeah, I think it can be many things, right? But like, it's more the aspect of focus, right? Okay. Because we, for example, go through a period of learnings and then we say, okay, look, this is maybe a bit too early. We were a bit too ambitious in this area. Let's try to kind of like work on the thing before, right? And let's focus to get this right. And then from there, from this great basis, we can then work towards that goal. That would be, for example, one of the things. Or we see that we have like, oh, growth in customers. Our customers, we call them either offline customers or online customers, right? Yeah. And we could say, okay, look, we have tried to kind of attack these offline customers, but we have had this great learning on online customers here, right? Oh, this is something that we really want to exploit in this quarter, this learning. But let's be flexible enough to say, okay, we are going to reduce the offline customer goal. We're increasing the online customer goal because of that learning that we have gotten. The overall goal of the company is still, we need to achieve this amount of customers, right? But how the composition might be is going to change. And rather than following another 2 months, this kind of outdated goal, right? Mm-hmm. We are going to kind of take this and change our goal, right? Like, and I think that is important in any business, as long as you can kind of still reconcile it with the overall goals of the company, right? Otherwise, you're just going to run after something so that your performance review looks good, because we do performance reviews in every quarter. Mm. And yeah, we don't want people to just point at the number and say, look, this number was what you gave me, and we are now here. But like the whole company is like going somewhere else, right? Yeah. That's, I think, in our stage, very, very important. We are like 35 people, right? Like full-time people. So
no, it's I mean, I've been in a startup where it was like slightly just a bit more. And so I can definitely agree with you that, you know, a lot of things change, especially when you're not entirely convinced about your PMF and things like that. So, you know, those things are always going to change a little bit, right? So that's why I wanted to sort of dive in a little bit more, so, you know, see how, you know, how does Matthias's brain tick, right? You know, because I think it's great. So another question is, when, so you're talking about how their OKRs and the OKRs are then passed on to the product teams and the product managers. But earlier on, you know, you'd also alluded to the fact that, you know, the product managers in general in Nairobi are not at that mature stage or as mature as some of the other continents, right? How do you help your product managers to sort of deal with that? Like, you know, if let's say that, is it the case where, you know, it's their first time understanding OKRs? Like, how did you guide them to like, okay, this is what you do? Was it more of like, here are some articles, go read it, go figure it out? Or do you like, okay, this is the first quarter, we're going to do OKRs, I'm going to teach you how to do it, I'm going to set it for you. What's your style like of, you know, passing on information like that?
I think it's exactly as you just described it. Like, we are doing this across the whole company. So we are like having a big effort to make people understand them, how they work, how they're all laddering up to it. So there was a couple of sessions around this at the beginning, like generally how OKRs are being used. But when it goes into the day-to-day and new team members come in, I think there are two important things. Like, first of all, it's like making the people realize that what they put on this paper, right, matters, right? And I think this is the biggest thing, right? Like, it's like I'm not just putting something on this paper and then I'm landing somewhere else, right? I'm like kind of wanted to go here, I'm ending up here, and I'm still getting a good evaluation. No, right? It's like you're putting these things on paper. Like, if you don't make sure that I am aware that something changed, sort of, right? Like, that's why the one-on-ones are important. Is, yeah, it's your fault. Like, I, as in, like, it's your bad, like, mm-hmm. if you want so, right? Like, of course, like, my fault in some way, I didn't bring it across to you that it's so important. But that's what I'm trying to make sure that people understand, that this is essentially their evaluation sheet that they're preparing and that they're going to circle back at the end of the quarter or at the end of the period. And the second thing is that I'm doing, as you just said, like at the beginning, for people that are maybe not as familiar with this method, being very hands-on, helping them prepare their OKRs, explain them why their OKRs are like that. Especially when they're new in the company, it's very tough to understand how all these things come together. Mm. But then after the first quarter, maybe it's then the person's job to make the first draft. And then I give reviews about this. And we maybe sometimes even go back and forth two or three times in order to get it right. I think a part that is tough, but that I want to introduce is like that the impact sizing of things, right? Like, it's obviously all meant to be measurable, and but sometimes it's very tough to kind of do this, especially when you're in a young business. You're like, oh, can I now grow 2x or is 5x the thing to do, right? Like, this is so it is oftentimes like we as a company know for our next funding round we need to be here. And broken this down over the quarters lands us for the next quarter is that goal. And that means for you, it's this goal, right? And so that's a bit like how it is now. Okay. But I wish that it moves more towards, it comes from you knowing your business and your part. You tell me what is possible, right? Mm-hmm. And then we build this up from the other side. But I think, yeah.
Okay. All right. So because Kapu is an early stage startup, right? And you're saying, you know, it's not like this huge company. So obviously there is a lot of, you know, and we just talked about this, how you tend to pivot, you tend to change. And one of the biggest struggles of doing product in such an environment is that a lot of things change. A lot of things are fluid. And I'm assuming that that is the case in Kapu as well. And a lot of the changes sometimes may not necessarily be what one team wants. So an example of that is, for Kapu, for example, you as the CPO, you want to drive towards, you know, a product, a more product-driven way of doing things. You know, the Kapu app should be doing this, la-di-da-da-da-da. But on the other hand, right, you've got your sales team that's trying to like close this deal. And I'm like, hey, guys, can you just help me to do this so that, you know, the people who are using it can do that? And because it's early stage, that tends to be usually that you know, debate or, you know, that push and pull.
Yeah.
How do you deal with that?
I think it's like, yeah, there's a big problem. But I think you have to be prepared to flush your pride down the toilet. In the sense that, you know, yeah, of course, am I proud in terms of every product I'm launching? No, right? Because I know that this could be much better, right? But it is good enough to do what it's meant to do, right? And I think that's what I was kind of like alluding to at the beginning when we talked about having started a startup, right? It doesn't matter, right? Like nobody's going to give you a trophy for having built this product that has no bugs, right? Like, and then you're going to kind of die in beauty because your company is not going to achieve the goals, right? Like, what you care about is like that you're achieving the company goals, right? And as long as that is happening, right? And that basically means that your customers want what you have to offer, that your sales team can use what they're meant to use, right? Mm-hmm. Then that is the goal. And I think that's what we as product managers need to do. Mm-hmm. And that is at least what we at Kapu are doing, right? And I think it is important to kind of like to drive this narrative all the time, yeah. Right? It's better learn early, fail fast, than kind of like hold it out until you think it's perfect. And then you bring it out there, right? Mm-hmm. And or like you're building something that you know is going to improve how 20% of users are going to use your product, but you could at the same time build something that, let's say, if you had a sales team, how your sales team is going to kind of sell your product, mm-hmm. right? And that is going to have a bigger impact. And I think that this notion of, yeah, but like, you know, we're not creating customer value, right? Like now, that is, I think, not true, because like the way, in my opinion, to look at this is to say, like, if you're going to stick around as a company, right, you're going to create tremendous customer value over the long run. But you're kind of like, you're specifically saying, okay, I cannot create this right now, right? But if I was to create it right now, it might be out of business. If I do too many of these nice things, right, then I might not be there anymore to kind of make a real impact on society for whatever solution or whatever thing that you are doing, right? And yeah, painful, but... necessary, I think.
I agree with you. I agree. So last question on this, right? So again, the other dichotomy or the paradox that exists, I think you actually mentioned it just now, right? Is this, how beautiful should it be before you ship, right? Because on one hand, you could choose, I mean, you know, there's this, I can't remember who said this, right? But you know, if you're not ashamed of what you've shipped, you're shipped too slow, right? And so that's one thought. And the other one, the other side of that fence is, hey, if you're not going to do things properly, you're going to end up, you know, creating possibly an experience that turns people off and they may not come back. And I think this paradox still exists in many companies, especially in the early stage, right? You know, sometimes it's the product side, or, you know, sometimes even it's on the engineering side. It's like, hey, you know, if you're releasing this and we don't have, you know, all the load balancers and everything in place, this thing will, you know, fail if it scales. And then you're like saying, but look, nobody's using it. Like, what balancing do you want to do? You know, it's one part. Sometimes it's the other side. They say, hey, you know, my customer wants this, or the user needs this. And, you know, if you ship it just like that without this other functionality, it's just going to solve the partial problem. La-di-da. Like, I don't know whether you encounter this at Kapu, but how do you deal with that?
I think it's important to, I think you need to understand what are the things that are like crucial to get right, and what are the things where you can be a bit less, you know, like, less anal about, and like say, okay, fine, we're going to test this out here, right? I think that's one of the reasons why we invested very early on in the ability to experiment and have feature flags and do things, you know, like we, for give you a good example, like we have rebuilt a whole part of our backend recently. So we are an e-commerce business, right? So like, it's all about like managing the product catalog. Yes. And the product catalog is connected to the inventory, and the product catalog is connected to the order system. So it's a big piece, and that we have kind of taken out and built our own and wanted to put it in. It's going to affect everyone, right? And that is a bad experience, because that's the core of what you're doing. So if you're launching that, it's bad, it's too slow, it doesn't work, right? So what we have adopted is like canary releases, right? Like we kind of put it out there for 2 hours, pull it back, see what happens, right? Put it out there, pull it back. And we did this over like 2 weeks, I think 6 times. Every time we learned, we fixed bugs, we released, we fixed bugs, we released, we fixed bugs. So the impact was very little. The impact could have been huge, right? If we had just put it out and said, okay, we're going to fix it along the way, we would have seen a drop in sales. We would have seen a drop in like customer satisfaction, of course, right? But I think like you need to just know where these pockets that you cannot make a mistake, and then don't make a mistake, or like have the impact be little, as small as possible. And then all the other things are there to play for. Right. And that's, I think, where your quote of like, if you are not ashamed of what you released too late, is exactly coming true. Right. It's kind of, yeah, just like do it. Right. Like just do it. It doesn't matter. And like, I think the important part is like praise people after that. Right. So for example, yesterday we released something and I was like out in the market to test it with a bunch of users. And yeah, did everything work? No, right? But I think that person that did this did an extra effort to get it out by Friday night, even though they gave us a timeline of next Wednesday, right? And, you know, I could have now come back and said, like, look, this, and that didn't work. Next time this person is going to say, I'm not going to release it anymore, right? Yeah. Because I'm not getting shit from people for this. Yeah. But I think you need to make an effort, a conscious effort to say, great job. You have done well, right? Like appreciate this piece because it has gotten us so many learnings that we've gotten on Friday that we could have otherwise only gotten on next Wednesday, because the extra piece that you would have built would have totally not solved for the learning that I have gotten today. And I think this is very important in like, kind of like to build this culture of I'm going, taking risks, right? What I did recently, I mean, Airbnb, I just read something. There was this Lenny's podcast, which I'm listening to sometimes. I really like that. And there was a quote about like Airbnb does 92% of their experiments fail. Right. And I think that's a culture. If 90, you know how many experiments you must be doing that you're still at that level where Airbnb is and that is successful, but that you can still have 92% of them fail. Yeah. It's because like you're kind of creating this environment of people like try things out, be innovative. Right. And so ship early and fail is I think what we're trying to go for.
Okay. All right. Hey, Matthias, thank you so much for taking the time. I know it felt a little bit more of a grilling towards the end, but I was really, really keen to understand, how does, and I think the listeners and the viewers would appreciate it, right? You know, because I'm not just like saying, oh, this beautiful stuff. Like, let's try and go a little bit deeper and, people can understand. Hopefully, it's very different when A, you are a product leader, B, when you're in an early stage startup, and C, when you're in a country where the scene may not be as mature. So hopefully, that came out and that came across properly as well. And I know we took a little bit more time as well, so I hope you don't mind that. As we close, Matthias, is there anything that you want to leave with our listeners and our viewers, any pearls of wisdom, any final thoughts before we close today's episode?
I think I just maybe want to iterate on this point that you mentioned, right? Like, how do you get into product management, depending on who listens? But I think there is no one way. And if you don't feel that you are hustling your way in, then you're doing something wrong. Because then you're not demonstrating the skill set that is required in order to succeed. So I think, I really appreciate if people are like, just pinging me on LinkedIn saying, I'm interested in something. I've done X, Y, Z, showing the interest. I think that's the way that you have to do it in order to break into product management. And, I'd appreciate that more people would be doing that. So yeah.
I fully agree, right? I mean, because it resonates with me, because personally I feel the same way. Like, you know, product management is all about, you know, being proactive and you know, that desire needs to be there. Like, I feel like people, if you don't have that drive, I feel it's going to be very hard for you to succeed as a product person, right? Because it is that almost inane drive to make something work when in normal circumstances it should fail, that sort of allows product people to do some really crazy stuff, right? And we've seen all these startups that and all these crazy stories. So yeah, fully agree with you there. I mean, I think it's fantastic. So once again, Matthias, thank you so much for coming on today's episode. And for the rest of you, I think, you know, as Matthias said, right? Add him on LinkedIn, ping him, tell him I want to go to Africa and join you in Kapu. And hopefully, you know, Matthias, we'll one day be able to come back for like part two of this session. And, you know, by that time, I'll be talking to Matthias Kratz, you know, CPO of Kapu Series D, right? And, you know, by that time, you'll probably be in like 10 countries in the sub-Saharan Africa. And yeah, that would be an amazing story to follow up on. So thank you so much. Once again, thank you all for listening. Thank you all for watching. And I'll catch you at the next episode. Bye-bye.